This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hello, Internet, and welcome to the second full episode of Quiz and Hers Season 19. My name is Justin. I am here, as always, with my wife, Hallie.
Hi.
Hi. Baby's fine, don't worry.
Okay.
He's sleeping, or mostly anyway. Anyway, yes, so this is, as always, the trivia podcast where we test each other's knowledge and the strength of our relationship in a 10-week battle for glory. And returning listeners know that my brain and your brain are pudding right now because we just had a baby, and so we're very sleep-deprived, but we soldier onward. So, non-returning listeners, if this is the first time tuning into this show, boy, you are in for whatever the opposite of a treat is right now, because this season is not going to be good.
Why not?
Because we are not sleeping?
It'll be fine.
Okay. For those new listeners, here's how it works. Each week, one of us writes six trivia questions to ask the other person, one from each of our six different categories, which are arts and literature, times and places, sports and games, movies and TV, music, and everything else. And following each question, the person who wrote it will talk about the answer for a few minutes so we can learn a bit more about that subject and be better prepared if we ever get a question about it in the future. And whoever has the most correct answers at the end of 10 real episodes, not including the little mini-pods in between each week, the person who has the most correct answers will be the Season 19 champion and the first ever 10-time champion because we're tied with 9 season championships apiece. So as of now, we've played one game this season. Hallie, you got 3 correct answers 2 weeks ago. Nicely done.
Thank you.
And this week, you will be asking me questions, and I will have a chance to try to close that 3-point deficit. So, what is the theme of this week's game?
All right. Today, I ask you, state your name.
Okay.
Because
it's Justin. I just said that.
Every answer has the name of a state. Particularly a United States state.
In the answer.
Yeah.
Okay. But the answer may not be just the name of a state, but it will be contained in the answer. Okay. Oh, that's fun. That's a good wordplay category.
Yep.
All right. Hit me.
Question one is times and places. The Pearl Harbor National Memorial in Oahu includes 3 ships that were attacked on December 7th, 1941. Name any one of these ships.
The USS Arizona.
Yeah, that's the easy one.
I don't know. Missouri is one of them? No? Mississippi.
It's the Utah and Oklahoma.
Okay, I would never
I mean, there were a bunch of them. They were all named first states, but those are the ones that are in the memorial.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Arizona's the only one I know.
Yeah. So, I'm talking about Pearl Harbor.
The battle?
Yeah.
I just did a World War II battle last week when we talked about or 2 weeks ago when we talked about Midway.
True. Sorry.
That's all right. Doesn't matter.
At 7:48 a.m. Hawaiian time on December 7th, 1941, 353 Imperial Japanese aircraft attacked the U.S. Naval Base at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu on the southeast coast of the island of Oahu.
Yes.
1 year prior, the Japanese invaded French Indochina, after which U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt moved the Pacific Fleet of the Navy from San Diego to Hawaii. In 1941, the United States and Japan tried to negotiate and improve their relations, but they could not come to an agreement. On November 26th, the U.S. proposed the Hull Note, which required Japan to evacuate China without any conditions, and obviously Japan did not agree.
No.
But that's a good thing to know, the Hull Note.
Hull, H-U-L-L,
yeah.
Like the hull of a ship?
Mm-hmm.
Except presumably it's a person's name.
There's a mnemonic, I guess. Think about the
hull
ships.
Of a ship. Yeah. No, never heard of that.
Yeah.
Cool.
It was after this that Emperor Hirohito gave final authorization to attack Pearl Harbor. The plan to attack Pearl Harbor actually began early in 1941 with Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto leading Japan's combined fleet.
Right. We talked about him 2 weeks ago. He's the head of the Imperial Japanese Navy, basically.
Yeah.
He also planned the Battle of Midway, which we just spoke about.
Yep.
This came 6 months prior to that.
Right.
Pearl Harbor was 6 months before Midway.
After it was authorized on November 26th, 6 Japanese aircraft carriers left Japan and headed for an area northwest of Hawaii. The first attack wave involved 183 planes launched north of Oahu. As they approached Oahu, they were detected by the U.S. Army SCR-270 radar, one of the first early warning radars which was in training mode but not yet operational. The operators reported it to Private Joseph P. McDonald at Fort Shafter's Intercept Center, where Lieutenant Kermit A. Tyler assumed it was just the B-17 bombers scheduled to arrive from California.
Right, I've heard this, that there were like two or three chances that they could have scrambled jets to, or I guess not jets at the time, but scrambled planes to intercept, and everyone was just like, that's probably nothing.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah, that's they were bad. Like, eh, it's training, whatever.
Yikes.
When the planes approached, they shot down U.S. aircraft, some of whom tried to warn the rest, but by the time the warnings were processed, the Japanese air assault had begun.
There it is.
The first attack was by torpedo bombers to get the battleships, then dive bombers attacked the U.S. air bases across the island. The U.S. ships were totally unprepared, but many responded effectively. The attack ended 90 minutes after it started. 2,008 sailors were killed, and another 710 were wounded. In total, 2,403 Americans were killed, and 1,143 were wounded.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So that's like including civilians, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
18 ships, including 5 battleships, were sunk or run aground. Almost half of the fatalities were due to the explosion of the USS Arizona's forward magazine.
Right.
The USS California was hit by 2 bombs and 2 torpedoes and may have stayed afloat, but the crew were ordered to abandon ship. The USS West Virginia was hit by 7 torpedoes, and the USS Oklahoma was hit by 4. The civilian casualties included 9 Honolulu Fire Department firefighters, another 6 of whom were wounded. Those wounded didn't receive Purple Hearts until the 43rd anniversary of the attack in 1984, and are the only firefighters in U.S. history to receive the award.
Presumably because they were not military personnel and therefore wouldn't be eligible for it normally?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
The day after the attack, Franklin Delano Roosevelt made his famous speech in which he said, quote, "Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy."
Mm-hmm.
In his speech, he called for a formal declaration of war against Japan, and Congress proceeded. A few days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the U.S.
This was back when Congress could proceed to do anything.
Right.
Haha, topical politics jokes.
Yeah. Like, they just got it done right then. Like, as if that would ever happen now.
Right. Nowadays, one party would support declaring war and the other one would obstruct. And right. I'm not really even sure which would be which. It probably depends on which president called for the declaration.
Yep. Exactly.
Yep. The world is a nightmare.
Yep. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were relocated to internment camps. In the end, almost 110,000 Japanese Americans were forced into the camps. However, in Hawaii, where over 150,000 Japanese Americans made up over 1/3 of the population, only 12 to 1,800 were interned.
Only?
I know, it's still not
still
great.
Still terrible and a massive violation of civil rights.
Yeah,
but
horrible.
Yeah.
Like, crazy. I don't understand how they could do that while, like, the Holocaust was going on and stuff like that.
Well, so part of it was that no one at the time in the U.S. knew quite how bad the Holocaust was. Like, they sort of knew it was happening, but it wasn't, like, really top of mind. The other thing was that, like, the Holocaust wasn't really why we were in the war. Like, you know, despite it being the largest genocidal act in history, that wasn't what pulled us in. It was
right.
Pearl
well,
Harbor
it should have been.
And the fact, well, it should have been, but it was the attack on Pearl Harbor and the fact that Germany and Italy were allied with Japan. That's the reason. Like,
yeah.
You know, there was no
well, that's like a
military
big,
justification, I guess, related to the Holocaust.
That's like a big criticism of FDR.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And a fair one, for sure.
Yeah. Also based on the attack, the government of Canada forced the removal of all Japanese Canadians from British Columbia.
What?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Me neither.
Jeez.
Today in the United States, December 7th is known as National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, but it is not a national holiday.
No.
Like I mentioned in the question, the USS Arizona Memorial is in Oahu and honors the dead.
Yep. And there was a Michael Bay movie called Pearl Harbor that is apparently wildly historically inaccurate, as all Michael Bay movies are.
Yeah. All right. Question 2 is arts and literature. What artist, best known for creating the love image, also created sculptures of the numbers 0 through 9, which have been on display in several cities since they were created in 1980?
So I don't know, but one useful trivia skill I have is that I'm able to run through all of the states alphabetically in my head, and the one that sounds the most like a last name would be Washington. So I'm going to guess his last name was Washington. And I only need to give the last name because standard trivia rules. So, Washington.
No.
Fuck. All right.
It's Robert Indiana.
You're kidding me.
I'm not.
That's a real name?
No, it's not.
Oh, well, okay. There it is. Fuck. All right.
But it is his name, regardless.
All right.
It is the name you need to know for trivia purposes.
I've never heard that name.
Robert Indiana was born Robert Clark in Newcastle, Indiana, on September 13th, 1928.
Oh, so he Tennessee Williams'd it. He just took the name of the state?
Tennessee Williams just took the name of the state?
Yeah, it's not his real name.
Oh, oh really, I could have talked about
him. Did you really
him.
Think his birth name was Tennessee?
I don't know, but I could have talked about him. That was a missed opportunity.
You should have. That would be so much more relevant.
It would. Oh, damn. I think they're both on my list, actually. Now I want to check. Yeah, they're both on my list. Gah!
Jeez. All right, well, I'll do a sequel episode to this one.
Okay. When he was a baby, he was adopted by Earl Clark and Carmen Waters. He attended Arsenal Technical High School in Indianapolis and graduated as valedictorian. He then spent 3 years in the U.S. Armed Forces and then studied at the Art Institute of Chicago from 1949 to 1953.
I've talked about their museum previously.
Yep. He also studied at Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture in Maine and Edinburgh University and Edinburgh College of Art. In 1954, he moved back to the U.S. and lived in New York City. In 1956, Indiana met his partner Ellsworth Kelly, a painter, sculptor, and printmaker. You may have heard of him.
Nope.
Okay. They found Indiana a studio where he had other artists as neighbors, including Jack Youngerman, Agnes Martin, and Cy Twombly. I've never heard of Cy Twombly.
Never heard of any of them.
He officially,
this is going real well.
Yeah. He officially changed his name to Indiana in 1958. In 1964, architect Philip Johnson commissioned Indiana to create a sign for the New York World's Fair that said EAT, like E-A-T.
At Joe's, except not.
What?
Nothing, forget it.
Okay. However, the sign was turned off the day after the fair opened because people mistakenly thought it marked a restaurant, which is totally understandable.
Yeah, that's a very reasonable mistake. Why did it say EAT for no reason?
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe it was a commentary. I don't know.
Everything's a fucking commentary with these people.
Like EAT, most of Indiana's works depict simple and direct words. Some other examples are die, hug, air, like E-R-R, and love.
Love is the famous one, obviously.
Yeah. The love image was created by Indiana in 1964 as a card, which he sent to his friends. It has the letters L and O above the letters V and E in the font Didone.
Okay.
The O is tilted sideways, and that's basically
That's it.
In 1965, the Museum of Modern Art featured it on their annual Christmas card, which became one of the most popular cards they've ever offered. In 1966, he created the first love sculpture in aluminum, and in 1970, he created the first love sculpture in Corten steel, which is now at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
Hmm.
In Philadelphia, there is a love sculpture at John F. Kennedy Plaza, also called Love Park.
Yep. We've been there.
Yep. In 1973, the United States Postal Service commissioned a stamp with love for Valentine's Day. In 1977, Indiana created a Hebrew version with the Hebrew word for love, Ahava, which is at the Israel Museum Art Garden. In May 2011, a 12-foot love sculpture sold for $4.1 million. Aside from his word art, Indiana was also a set and costume designer. He designed the production of The Mother of Us All about Susan B. Anthony for the Santa Fe Opera in 1976. He also starred in Andy Warhol's film Eat, in which he spent 45 minutes eating a mushroom.
Art.
Yeah. Later in his life, Indiana moved to Vinal Haven, Maine. In his last years, he became reclusive. He died there in 2018 from respiratory failure.
There you go.
Yeah.
Indiana. What a name.
Yep. Question 3 is movies and TV. In what 1974 horror film, the first in a franchise, does a group of friends fall victim to a family of cannibals, one of whom is called Leatherface?
Yeah, I know this one. I was hoping the question would be who is the protagonist of Point Break, played by Keanu Reeves, because his name is literally Johnny Utah, which is like one of the worst character names ever.
I didn't know that.
But no, that would be the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Correct.
Yeah.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre was written by Tobe, unless it's pronounced Toby.
No idea. T-O-B-E?
Yeah.
Let's say it's Tobe.
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 What a name.
Come on, Tobe.
Tobe Hooper and Kim Henkel, and directed by Tobe Hooper. Hooper said that one inspiration for the film was San Antonio's news outlet's graphic coverage of violence. He was also inspired by murderer Ed... Is it? I think it's Gein?
Gein.
Ed Gein.
Ed Gein is the inspiration for...
I'm getting there.
Yeah, okay.
Who killed people in 1950s Wisconsin. Gein was also the inspiration for other films like Psycho and The Silence of the Lambs, which I assume...
Every movie.
The Silence of the Lambs, the book, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't it books first?
Yes, by Thomas Harris, yeah. Almost every movie serial killer is at least partially inspired by Ed Gein because he was just like, he was the first one to do all that creepy shit that you think of serial killers as doing. Although he didn't actually kill that many people, he mostly dug them up. But like, he liked to skin people and make a suit to be his mother out of human skin. Real fucked.
Gross.
Yeah. Anyway.
Apparently, the idea of using a chainsaw as a weapon came to Hooper when he was stuck in a busy hardware store and was thinking of how he could get through the crowd.
I think that guy might have some issues to work through.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that is super creepy, but I guess horror directors might be a little weird.
Yeah, probably.
Most of the cast members were unknowns. They were mainly Texans who'd previously starred in commercials, TV, and theater productions. For the opening credits, they got John Larroquette to provide the narration and paid him in marijuana.
That's fantastic.
Yep. The film takes place in Newt Muerto County, Texas. It starts out with a grave robber stealing remains from a cemetery and tying the rotting corpse and other body parts onto a monument, which is discovered by a local resident the following morning. It then switches to five people taking a road trip through the area. Their names are Sally Hardesty. I don't know. I've never seen this movie.
I mean, that's a real last name.
Okay, then Hardesty. Jerry, Pam, Kirk, and Sally's handicapped brother, Franklin. They pick up a hitchhiker who takes a photo of them. When they refuse to pay him for the photo, he attacks Franklin and smears a bloody symbol on the side of their van. When their van runs out of gas, they stop at a nearby abandoned house, which is owned by the Hardesty family. Kirk and Pam leave the others to go have sex, and they find a house nearby with gas-powered generators. Kirk goes into the house hoping to get gas, but he is attacked with a hammer by a large man wearing a mask made of skin. Pam then enters the house and is impaled on a meat hook. While she is watching, the man powers up a chainsaw to dismember Kirk's body. Jerry then comes to look for them, and after discovering Pam's nearly dead body in a freezer, is killed by the man, also with a hammer.
Sounds like this should have been called the Texas Hammer Massacre plus some chainsaws.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Sally and Franklin head toward the house at night, and on the way, the man kills Franklin with the chainsaw. The man then chases Sally to the gas station where he disappears. Then, because this isn't horrible enough, the proprietor of the gas station beats Sally and loads her onto his pickup truck. He takes her to the house where they find the hitchhiker who it turns out was the grave robber from the beginning. It also turns out that the hitchhiker and the masked man are brothers. The hitchhiker calls the masked man Leatherface. They bring the gas station proprietor to the basement and cut off Sally's finger. When she awakens, the men taunt her and decide to kill her with a hammer.
Texas Hammer Massacre.
They try to get the gas station guy involved, but he's too weak and drops the hammer, after which Sally breaks free and runs into the road. As they are chasing her, the hitchhiker is hit by a truck. Then the truck driver attacks Leatherface and escapes on foot. Sally flags down a passing pickup truck and climbs into the bed, escaping Leatherface. It ends with Sally laughing as she gets away on the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Not my kind of movie.
No, not really. And we're back after a short break that I will edit out in post. Our newborn is making his first appearance on the podcast. He should be napping right now, but he has the hiccups and he refuses to sleep. And he's making some weird noises from the other room, so I brought him in here to chill. If you hear weird coos and hiccups, that's just him. You can ignore him. So, you got anything you want to say to the audience, bud? Keeping in mind that you're 3 weeks old and can't speak yet? There you go.
It was a hiccup.
All right, I'll try to keep him off mic as best I can. Please continue.
Okay. Since the release of the film, there have been several sequels. The first one, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, was released in 1986. The second sequel was Leatherface, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 in 1990. Then in 1995, Texas Chainsaw Massacre The Next Generation was released and was basically a remake of the original plot-wise. An actual remake called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre was released in 2003. After that, a prequel called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre The Beginning was released in 2006. Another prequel, Leatherface, was released in 2017. And in 2022, Netflix released another sequel called Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
So are the prequels prequels to the original continuity or to the reboot? Like, what's the timelines here?
I don't know.
These horror franchises' continuities are always so fucked.
Yep. I don't like horror.
I mean, I like some good horror movies, but these, like, torture porn ones just have no merit to them, I don't think. They're nothing.
I'd rather watch, like, Criminal Minds where they try to figure out, like, what's going on and catch them.
Yeah, for sure. That's more thriller than horror, but yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right, then that brings us to halftime. Baby's keeping mostly quiet, so that's good. He is wide awake, that's not good. But anyway, this is where we take a brief pause in the middle of the game to thank you all for listening. And we hope you're enjoying the show. If you are, it would be great if you left us a rating and a review, and you could like and subscribe and all that. Hit all those buttons on your podcast app. Really does help us out. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can contact us via email. We are quizandhers@gmail.com. Or you can follow and interact with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are @quizandhers on all three of those platforms. And, as we always say, we are proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Feels like I got to that quickly. Did I forget something?
I don't know. I zoned out. I'm tired. Sorry.
Great. We are proud members of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. The website is still down for some reason. I don't really know what's going on with it. But, nonetheless, there are many other great podcasts that are members of said network. And so, we encourage you to check them out. And to get you started, we're going to send you over to a quick ad for one of them now.
Hey everyone, I'm Chris.
I'm Beth.
And I'm Matt.
Join us every Wednesday for Wasting Time, our podcast where we talk about pop culture, life, and our favorite things.
From the movies we love to the TV shows we're obsessed with.
And from politics to parenting to whatever else is on our mind.
Give us a listen each Wednesday and then find us on Facebook and Twitter to tell us what you're loving.
We're part of the Big Heads Media Group and we can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and wherever else you find your podcasts. Come waste some time with us.
All right, we're back. Hallie, back to you. Let's see if I can convince a baby to sleep and answer trivia questions at the same time. Here we go.
Okay. Question 4 is music. What rock band, originally named Saratoga, is best known for the hit singles Dust in the Wind and Carry On Wayward Son?
Ah, yes, Kansas.
Yep, it is Kansas.
Carry On Wayward Son is a great song.
It is. In Topeka, Kansas, in 1969, Don Montre and Kerry Livgren were in a band called The Reasons Why. They then formed the band Saratoga with Lynn Meredith on vocals and Dan Wright on the other things, and began playing Livgren's songs. They soon brought in Scott Kessler on bass and Zeke Lowe on drums. They merged with a band called White Clover, and this was known as Kansas One. Then those guys left to reform White Clover, and after that, they're known as Kansas Two. Very confusing.
Didn't know that.
Their self-titled debut album was released in 1974. It was a mix of boogie rock and complex symphonic arrangements. They followed that up with the albums Song for America and Mask in 1975. Carry On Wayward Son was on their fourth album, Leftoverture, which I think is a great name.
What was it? Leftoverture?
Like Leftoverture.
And Overture. That's fun.
And Dust in the Wind was on the one after that called Point of No Return, except it's spelled K-N-O-W.
Uh-huh, okay.
In May 1979, they released the album Monolith, which was self-produced. It had the top 40 hit People of the South Wind, which is a reference to the Kanza, or Kaw people, for whom Kansas is named.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Me neither. In the early 80s, Livgren became a born-again Christian, which was reflected in the lyrics on their next three albums, including the top 40 hit Hold On. Because of disagreements about the lyrics, Steve Walsh left to form another band called Streets. Kansas's next album in 1982, Vinyl Confessions, had their first top 20 hit in several years, and that was Play the Game Tonight. The album also had backing vocals from Roger Taylor of Queen, who happened to be recording next door.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. At this point, their lyrics were more Christian. However, their next album was more mainstream, and afterwards, Livgren, along with Dave Hope, left to form the Christian band AD. In 1985, Kansas formed again with Ehart, Williams, and Walsh. They went on a USO tour and then released the album Power. The song All I Wanted became their last top 40 single. In the 90s, they continued to tour with older and newer members. In July 2000, they released a new studio album, Somewhere to Elsewhere. Then in 2002, Kansas 2, the lineup before the release of their first album, released an album using the name Protocaw, which I guess also is related to the caw from Kansas.
That's probably a way of saying proto-Kansas, right? Like, we were Kansas before Kansas was Kansas. That's literally what they're saying.
Right.
That's clever.
Yeah. This led to two other studio albums in the 2000s. In July 2010, they toured with Styx and Foreigner. In 2014, lead singer Steve Walsh retired. They continued to tour in the 2010s. And in July 2020, they released a new studio album called The Absence of Presence. Their 50th anniversary will be 2023, and in honor of that, they released another fork in the road, 50 Years of Kansas.
Kansas Styx and Foreigner sounds like an awesome concert.
Yes, it does.
That sounds great. I really like Styx. I should talk about Styx at some point. They're, I think, massively underappreciated.
Yeah, I like them. Okay, question five is everything else. What are the first and last names of the physician who invented a way to assess the status of newborns, a test that is still performed today?
Well, I know the last name is Apgar because the test is named for this person and then it's like a backronym for the five parts of the test. No idea what the first name is. I'm guessing that's the state, since Apgar is not a state. So hang on, let me run through them and find one that sounds like a first name. Okay, so there are two states that are also first names, like commonly. Georgia and Virginia. I'm going to guess Virginia Apgar. I feel like that's slightly more common. I'm going to be real mad if it's Georgia.
It is Virginia.
Yes. Logic for the win. Yep. Puzzling things out.
Good for you. The Apgar score, like I said, is a way to evaluate the health of newborns. They are evaluated at 1 and 5 minutes after birth and in response to resuscitation.
We recently saw this with our own eyes. Not the resuscitation part, thankfully, but the 1 in 5 minutes thing.
We don't know what his Apgar score was, but we know it was good.
They said everything looked excellent, so I'm guessing it was a 10 out of 10.
Yeah. Virginia Apgar presented the Apgar score in 1952 at a meeting of the International Anesthesia Research Society and the International College of Anesthetists. I don't really understand why.
Right, you'd think it would be pediatricians or OBGYNs or something.
I know.
Weird.
It was also published in the journal Anesthesia and Analgesia in 1953.
Why?
I don't know. Really weird. After that, Apgar, along with Duncan Holliday and Stanley James, aimed to create the scientific basis for the score, because she just kind of, like, made it up.
Sure.
They published a study using the scores of 15,348 infants to show the association between a low Apgar score and lab findings of asphyxia. Today, the Apgar score is still used to evaluate newborns, but it is not used to determine the need for resuscitation anymore because resuscitation measures should be started before 1 minute after birth.
Well, yeah, if the baby's not breathing.
Right. The Apgar score is endorsed by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Academy of Pediatrics. The five criteria that comprise the Apgar score are skin color, pulse rate, reflex irritability grimace, muscle tone, and respiratory effort. Virginia Apgar turned her name into what's called a backronym, where each aspect can make the word Apgar. It's appearance, pulse, grimace, activity, and respiration. Each one is scored from 0 to 2. For skin color, 0 is blue or pale, 1 is blue at extremities with a pink body, and 2 is no cyanosis with pink extremities. Apparently, it's pretty common for them to have blue extremities.
Yeah.
I don't think he did.
No, I don't think so.
For pulse rate, 0 is absent, 1 is less than 100 beats per minute, and 2 is over 100 beats per minute. For reflex irritability grimace, 0 is no response to stimulation, 1 is grimace on suction or aggressive stimulation, and 2 is cry on stimulation. So that just means, like, do they cry?
Right, do they react when you annoy them, basically. Yeah.
For muscle tone, 0 is none, 1 is some flexion, and 2 is flexed arms and legs that resist extension. Finally, for respiratory effort, 0 is absent, 1 is weak, irregular, and gasping, and 2 is strong, robust cry.
He sure had that when he was born.
Yeah. Very robust.
My God, he was so loud from the moment he came out.
Yep. When you add together the scores, 7 or above is normal, 4 to 6 is fairly low, and 3 and below are critically low and cause for immediate resuscitative efforts. However, if the score improves from the 1-minute mark to the 5-minute mark, there isn't necessarily a long-term problem. If it is below 7 at the 5-minute mark, the score should be reassessed every 5 minutes for up to 20 minutes. A score lower than 3 at 10, 15, or 20 minutes can be a sign of neonatal encephalopathy. As of 2009, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended that the APGAR score be done while skin-to-skin contact is underway. Skin-to-skin contact is when the baby lays on the parent's bare chest immediately after birth.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay. I wonder why that was top of mind for you this week.
Yep. I don't know. All right. The final question is sports and games.
How many have I gotten? 4?
Yeah.
Nice.
You might get this one too. You probably will. After winning a national championship with Notre Dame, what quarterback went on to become the first player to be Super Bowl MVP 3 times while playing for the San Francisco 49ers?
Yeah. Joe Montana.
That's correct.
Sweet. 2-point lead.
Joseph Clifford Montana Jr. was born on June 11th, 1956 in New Eagle in western Pennsylvania, and was raised in Monongahela, a coal mining town south of Pittsburgh. The last name Montana was from the Italian Montani. Growing up, he played football, baseball, and basketball. His father, Joe Montana Sr., started a basketball team in their town, and they competed in regional tournaments. Joe was so good at basketball that during his senior year of high school, he was offered a basketball scholarship from North Carolina State University. Although he was tempted by the prospect of getting to play both football and basketball in college, he ultimately accepted a football scholarship from Notre Dame. As a freshman, he was not allowed to play on the varsity team, but his sophomore year, he played a couple of games, entering in the fourth quarter. Before his junior year, he hurt his shoulder and was granted a redshirt waiver so he could play another year. In his second junior year, he began as the third quarterback, but after the second quarterback got severely injured in a game against Purdue, they put Montana in, and he got the team from losing 24-14 to a comeback in which they won 31-24. As a fifth-year senior in 1978, Notre Dame went to the Cotton Bowl, in which they played against Houston. During the game, Montana almost got hypothermia and had to go to the locker room and be given warmed IV fluids and chicken soup.
What?
Yeah. When he came back late in the third quarter, they were down 34-12. In the last 8 minutes of the game, Montana led them to 3 touchdowns and they won 35-34.
Jeez.
The game is now known as the Chicken Soup Game.
Oh, that's what that is. I've heard that term. I never knew what that was.
Yep.
Cotton Bowl, you said?
Yeah.
Wow.
Montana was not highly rated for the NFL draft. I'm not really sure why, based on what I've said already, but he was not. In the 1979 draft, he was selected as the 82nd overall pick by the San Francisco 49ers. He was the fourth quarterback taken after Jack Thompson, Phil Simms, and Steve Fuller. Montana spent his first season as a backup quarterback, then became the starting QB halfway through the 1980 season. Although the team finished the season 6-10, Montana had a 64.5% completion percentage, which led the league. For not football people, that means that 64.5% of the passes he threw were caught.
Right.
The following season, they finished with a 13-3 record. They made it to the NFC Championship, in which they played the Dallas Cowboys. Montana led them to a win with a touchdown pass with 51 seconds left in the game. In Super Bowl 16, they played the Bengals and they won 26-21. That could happen.
Yeah, we could get Niners-Bengals this year. We're recording this a couple weeks before it comes out, so I guess by the time this comes out, we'll know who's playing. Yeah, we'll know who's playing in the Super Bowl.
But we won't know if the 49ers will win. But
not yet, no. Correct.
But hopefully they will.
As Ravens fans, we don't like the Bengals.
Right.
Fuck you, Joe Burrow. You fucking... Anyway.
Okay. This was Montana's first MVP award. This also made Montana the second person to win a college national championship and a Super Bowl after Joe Namath, They are still the only two to have done this.
Wait, what?
There are only two people to win a college national championship and a Super Bowl.
As quarterbacks or at any position? Surely that's just
It must just be quarterback, right?
Joe Namath, yeah.
I double-checked that they were the only two still, but let me see.
That's... Wow.
Yes, it's quarterbacks.
I mean, that's still very surprising, but...
Oh, the article is like, Joe Burrow can hit first ever quarterback triple crown.
What's the third one?
I don't know, I'm checking.
Because I was going to say, Joe Burrow won a national title at LSU, could be the third.
But it's those two plus the Heisman.
Oh.
Apparently your name needs to be Joe. That's as far as I've gotten.
Okay.
If you want your kid to be an amazing football quarterback, you should name him Joe. But anyway, I hope he doesn't.
Yep, fuck you, Burrow. You smug prick.
I feel like Joe Montana is humble. And Joe Namath. I don't know. In the 1984 season, the 49ers became the first team to win 15 games in the regular season with a record of 15-1. They made it to Super Bowl 19 against Dan Marino and the Miami Dolphins. During the game, Montana set a record for most yards passing in a Super Bowl game, and the 49ers won 38-16, and he won the MVP award again.
Rightly so.
In 1986, Montana had a bad back injury, and his doctors even thought he should retire. He missed a couple of months, but returned in November. In his first game back, they defeated the St. Louis Cardinals 43-17. Before the 1987 season, the 49ers got Steve Young, another quarterback. By the following season, it was unclear whether he or Montana should be the starting quarterback. However, Montana still got most of the playing time. They made it to Super Bowl 23, playing the Cincinnati Bengals again. During the game, Montana completed 23 of 36 passes for 357 yards, another record at the time. They were down 16-13 with 3 minutes and 20 seconds left. Montana completed 8 out of 9 passes for 92 yards and threw the game-winning touchdown pass. The following year, they made it to Super Bowl 24, in which they defeated the Denver Broncos 55-10, the highest score and most lopsided score in Super Bowl history. In that game, Montana became the first player to win the Super Bowl MVP 3 times. Montana missed the 1991 season and most of the 1992 season with an elbow injury. In the last game of the 1992 regular season, Montana stepped in for the second half and won the game, but Young was already established as the 49ers' starting quarterback and took over in the playoffs. In 1993, Montana was traded to the Kansas City Chiefs. He helped them get to the AFC Championship that year, but they lost to the Bills and he suffered a concussion. They made the playoffs again the following year, but lost in the wild card round. In April 1995, Montana announced his retirement. His other NFL records that I haven't mentioned are most pass attempts without throwing an interception in a Super Bowl, and most wins in a Super Bowl without a loss, which is tied with Terry Bradshaw.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a good fact.
Yeah. Since his retirement, he bought land in Calistoga, California, where he makes wine under the label Montagia. He also devotes his time to charitable causes like the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah, cool. I mean, that's our retirement plan, make wine and do charitable work, right?
Pretty much.
If only we had Super Bowl winning Sounds quarterback
great.
Money,
yeah.
Then we could do that.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the end of the game, and I got 5 correct answers, so I'm feeling pretty good about that. So I'm up 5-3 on this young season.
Not good for me.
Not great for you, no, but pretty good for me. And, of course, that brings us to our final segment of the show. As with every full-length episode, we close with Fact or Fucked. This week's Fact or Fuck comes to us from our fan Maggie. She actually sent it as part of a double feature with last week's. So here's what she says. In 1852 in Leicester, the first ever crisps factory, that's chips factory if you're American, exploded, showering the surrounding streets with a rain of unsalted potato slices. It's known as the Leicester Potato Storm.
Well, that sounds insane. But last week's was true.
It was. 2 weeks ago, you mean, but yes.
Yeah.
I know, it's hard to get out of that habit of saying last week.
That was about beer.
That's right.
No, this seems too insane. Fucked.
It is fucked, yes. So she actually sent this as a package deal. One of these is true and one is false, but which is which? And she actually, she cribbed these from an Instagram account called Very British Problems Official.
Okay.
Which is quite funny, and I will probably be giving them a follow.
Yeah.
But yes, it is fucked. That never happened. The beer thing.
Too bad.
The beer flood in London happened, but the Leicester potato storm did not. So
I want to go and have some real London chippies.
These were crisps, not chips. What they call chips is what we call fries.
Oh,
and what
damn.
They call crisps is what we call chips.
I think I just want fries. I was thinking about fries.
No, this was what we would call potato chips, what they would call crisps. But
either way.
I like fries and chips, or
me
chips
too.
And crisps if you're British.
Very confusing.
Which we're not, yes. Anyway, thank you, Maggie. That was a good one. That was fun.
Yep.
And so next week, consistent with our new format, we will have a little mini episode, a second episode of Learned Lately, in which I will be talking about something that I've just encountered recently that piqued my interest. And then 2 weeks from now, we'll be back with the next full-length episode of this season, when Hallie will have a chance to try to dig herself out of this two-point hole she's gotten herself in.
Yep. We will see.
Yep. And that should do it for today, I think. Anything to add?
Nope.
Hopefully the baby will sleep better next time. We'll
see. We can hope.
Yeah. All right. See you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
The five criteria that comprise the APGAR score are skin color. He's licking my leg all over.
To be clear, the dog, not the baby.
Yeah.